Thank you, Catherine, and congratulations on your new appointment to elevated and important status in the life of the nation. And thank you, Jane, for your expert and detailed account. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional lands we are on, the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I recognise their ancestors and them as the custodians of this place. It may look like a hearing room at the Human Rights Commission. We've lost the E and the O. At the Hurrick, but it is in fact always was and always will be Aboriginal land. I'll be fairly brief this afternoon. I guess Jane and I had a bit of a double act. Jane to lay out the case for complementary protection and what it might be and how it could look, what it looks like around the world, and for me to give some examples, I guess, of the need for complementary protection through the work that we've been involved in. And we will make you, those of you who are willing, after a few some snacks, to sit and look at the film that we've just produced, which is tracking people who had been in Australia seeking asylum, on Nauru seeking asylum, to Afghanistan, to Syria, to Jordan, to Iran, to Turkey, down onto the Iraq border, and to also look at those examples of people, particularly in Canada, who had been rejected by Australia and were accepted. Again, these were people who were stateless. And I would endorse Jane's remarks that when we talk about complementary protection, the issue of statelessness is very much one that needs to be picked up. So I'd like to focus on those examples, but before that, I guess, the process that we've been involved in since 2003 has involved visiting some 22 countries, and we have made contact with over 250 people now. We formally interviewed just under 100 of those. The interesting thing is all of those people in all of those countries were in Australia at different times. They did not know each other. They represent different nationalities. They were in different detention centres when they were here, and yet their experience and their stories are remarkably similar. All but five of those people are now, in our view, are living in danger. Five of them are living in relative safety. The vast majority, the absolute majority, are living in danger. Before we publish any of this material, we have three processes that we have to go through. And the research writing team has been led by Dr. Carmel Levy, who is a magnificent 82-year-old Dominican nun, and she's not here, so therefore I can say how old she is. Who turned up on my doorstep some 7 or 8 years ago and said, I want a job, I can write, I can research, and I don't want any money. To which I said, sister, you must have certainly been born in a stable somewhere, you know. And she was awarded an Order of Australia by the Howard government for her skills as a researcher. She established a team of researchers, and some of whom are here today, Dr. Tony Morris, I can see at the back of the room, and at the same time established a committee, a committee of eminent lawyers and writers, journalists, who would oversee this to see that the language used and the conclusions drawn from the interviews were correct. And that also, we would then, after conducting formal interviews, would then see if the information gleaned there fitted with the reports from other primary and secondary sources of authority, be that Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the United Nations agencies, and then say, okay, if that fits, then thirdly, how does it reconcile with our observations on the ground? And then we would pass that information, if we've got the three ticks there, we would pass that through the Ethics Committee at the Australian Catholic University, and if we got the clearance from those four criteria areas, we were prepared to publish. And that was terribly important, because the very first thing is when you say that this has happened in Australia, that we've sent people back to their death, that we've sent people back to danger, the very first response we get is, oh, that cannot possibly be true. A classic case of this was of Mohammed Hossein, who you may have seen in the weekend's press. And I want to focus just on his story at the beginning, because it is a classic example of someone who had a case under the Convention Against Torture, which Australia is a signatory to. He was found, however, not to have a case under the Refugee Convention. He told Australian officials that if he was sent back, he would be tortured. Now, I met him in January of this year for the second time in Afghanistan, in Kabul. He had been living in Pakistan, where many of these asylum seekers from Nauru have been hiding, in Pakistan and in Iran, because it's simply not safe enough in Afghanistan for anybody to stay. I mean, we were arrested three times and held up at gunpoint as just walking down the street, and we could get out. For people who live there, who have genuine fears of what might happen, it is fundamentally different. It is not a safe country. It never was, and it isn't now. He was forced to flee from Pakistan in January just after the death of Benazir Bhutto, which led to a breakdown in the order in that particular province of Afghanistan, in Pakistan, Balochistan. And he came into Kabul and said he was in danger of being killed. Could we do something to help? We arranged to meet the next day. He didn't turn up for the arranged meeting in a safe house. We waited around for a few hours, and you'll see this in the film. He was kidnapped. He was taken away in a four-wheel drive with dark windows and was not heard of for some 2 months. He managed to escape that situation, and he fled into Iran, where he was arrested and deported back to Afghanistan after spending some 6 weeks in a detention centre on the border. He then made it back into Kabul some 6 weeks ago and gave a message to one of the bloc leaders from Nauru, Mohammed Karim Rizai, to say, could you get a message to Mr. Phil, please? And the message was, I'm about to be killed. Could you notify the Australian military or the US military or the United Nations or someone who could help me? Can I get to Indonesia or somewhere out of the country? I will soon be killed. The tragedy is, of course, I got that message last Wednesday night in the Hornsby Westfield shopping mall, where my mobile phone had gone off, and unfortunately Mohammed Hussein had been killed 25 days before then. He was kidnapped and taken in Ghazni province. He was taken to his home village and in front of his family and a range of other witnesses. He was thrown down a well, and a hand grenade was thrown in after him, and he was decapitated. I heard this story about 3 weeks ago through phone calls from people on the ground, and of course we've had that four processes of criteria to check before we can publish this. We couldn't say anything. You can't confirm it. You have to confirm the information before you can make it public, before we let the minister know. And as of last Friday night, we had it confirmed from four independent, separate sources in Afghanistan to say that this has in fact happened. He said he would be tortured if he went back. He said he would be killed if he went back. He simply wasn't believed. He was told that if he went back, it would be safe. You don't have a claim under the Refugee Convention. You can go back. He went back. What he said would happen has now happened. It seems to me that the time for complementary protection has arrived well and truly. Too late for him. But there are certainly for others the need, and the cases that we have encountered over the years would indicate that this is an urgent and a dire need. And I would was pleased to see today to turn up and see that there is a being distributed here the draft model for a complementary protection visa being circulated that the government are proposing. And of course what we're talking about with complementary protection is a visa category to cover the very things that we've already signed up to and agreed to. I mean, we've already signed the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. We've already signed the Convention Against Torture. And yet, at the same time, we're saying, yes, we've signed up to that. When it comes to the substance of saying we're going to follow that through with action, that didn't happen. And when you get that wrong, people die. We can confirm through our work that there are some 10 deaths now that have occurred for people who came to Australia to seek protection in Afghanistan, in Iran, in Colombia, in Pakistan and in Sri Lanka. As of I actually believe that's they're the ones we can absolutely rock solid confirm. Medical reports, newspaper accounts, UN support. In terms of what we've gleaned and what I believe the case is, I think it's far higher. I think it's more in the vicinity of 20. We travelled to Colombia to track 4 returned asylum seekers. And we got as far as the Bogota office of the UNHCR and had it confirmed there that one of those men, Alvaro Morales, was killed soon after he arrived. The 3 others, confirmed by the Ecumenical Commission for Social Justice and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, were that those people had disappeared and 2 of them didn't make it out of the airport car park. The reason they were rejected here were on issues, as Jane was explaining, with regards to you have a criminal record or you were involved in petty crime, therefore you don't have a case for fear. Now, these are very reputable people on the ground in Colombia that were saying to us, we warned the Australian government. The head of the UNHCR in Colombia at that time was the head of the UNHCR in Canberra, who warned the Australian government that if you send these people back, this will happen. And we're back and it happens. And when a number of people in this room were advocating for complementary protection to the then minister, the response was, well, if you put complementary protection up, it'll be like putting a bucket full of cash on the table and everybody's going to try and put their hand into it. So it seems to me it's very apt that we're having this meeting here in the Human Rights Commission, because at some point in our national life we have to take human rights seriously. And really it counts only when it's for those who are excluded or those that sit outside the domain of those who share our town, our views, the colour of our skin, and realise perhaps, or we need to realise, that the world doesn't end at the river shore. It doesn't end at the nearest hill. And that people have paid a significant price. Just to take this a little bit further, we also encountered in Afghanistan the reality of the 42 unaccompanied children who were sent back from Nauru. 42 unaccompanied children. Kabul is awash with homeless children. And you'll see some of those in the film. And yet, from Nauru, the children, of course, how do they put up a case to argue that they have a well-founded fear of persecution under the Refugee Convention? 42 unaccompanied minors went back. Now, their fate remains unknown and remains very difficult to trace. We encountered one day in Kabul, Mohammed Rizai said, there's some people we want you to see, and we have to have a meeting at a secret place, and this time we promise you won't get arrested, because every time he organised the meeting until then we would get arrested. We were getting to doubt the fact whether he had a career in sort of event management, you know. And he said, I've worked it out, we're going to meet at the car wash. Because Kabul has one car wash. And he said, when the cars are being washed, we'll meet at the room at the back. No one will ever suspect we would be there. It was a bit like the old, you know, Maxwell Smart chaos story. You know, the chaos had the Chinese laundry was the front for the chaos organisation. But the real money was in the Chinese laundry. Well, this was the reality. It was the hideout in this car wash, and there were 50 men that turned up that day. Most of them had papers saying they didn't have a well-founded fear of the Refugee Convention. There was one gentleman there who said to us, can you help me, please? No one believes my story. And his story, of course, would never fit under the Refugee Convention, because he was someone who fell in love with a niece of one of the major, very serious warlords who disapproved of the union, and they had a liaison, and he basically said, you know, this is illegal here under the way in which this person rules. He's detained me once, I've been beaten, I've been tortured, and of course he would not fit anywhere under a refugee convention, yet his fear was undoubtedly real, and of course sadly he has now disappeared. Absolutely does not mean that he's dead. It just means he's disappeared. He may be in hiding, and I hope he is. But it points to the fact that the frame that under which we've operated is fundamentally inadequate. The Refugee Convention doesn't go far enough, and the 417 discretionary measures available to the minister simply are unsatisfactory. I mean, I guess my plea would be from these 250 people that we've encountered over the last number of years, that Australia really needs to join the rest of the nations of Europe, the European Union, the United States, Canada, and soon New Zealand, in putting these measures in place. It's not all gloom and doom, though, because when countries do put these things in place, you get a different outcome. You'll see in the film the case of Mubarak and Nayef. Then the Mubarak Nayef now drives the midnight to dawn shift in a taxi in Ottawa in Canada. He rang me last Christmas Eve to say, "I am so happy, Phil, I'm so happy." "Why are you happy, Mubarak?" "I am so happy because I have a job, my wife is pregnant, and my citizenship comes through on January the 8th, 2008. I said, "What's the temperature?" He said, "Minus 35 degrees, it's wonderful." He took a great risk, this man, to assist us in this work. He'd been a Kuwaiti Badoon. He was a stateless Kuwaiti Badoon. And there was a whole pile of stateless Kuwaiti Badoons that the Howard government deported to Syria. And it was compounded by the fact that when they were deported, they were provided with the little blue certificates of identity that some of you would have seen that looked very similar to passports, valid for one-way travel. When Tony Morris and I were travelling to Damascus on one of these journeys, we encountered a range of people getting up just before the plane landed and moving through the plane to the front to receive these documents from someone who'd come out of the cockpit, would give them their Australian documents. They'd sit there and open them, and for some of them who thought they were going to Syria, being accepted by Syria, that they'd be there and able to live there for 15 years, they were told, would open these visas to find that they actually were valid for 3 months, some for 2 months, and in three famous cases, they lapsed before they arrived. They were arrested at the airport and taken straight to the jails in Damascus. Two of them they referred to as Arsenal and Manchester United were the two prisons. Mubarak assisted us in our research. He was one of our gatekeepers, I guess, because you can't do this work unless you've got someone to help you gain entree into it. But not long after we left, he was arrested. And he was found that his only identity he had was his Australian identity card, which had lapsed, which was no longer valid. We got a phone call from his brother in Canada, who said to us, "Can you please do something?" I remember we rang the Canadian embassy in Damascus and spoke to a man by the name of Garrett Kutzner, who I'll never forget. It was a Tuesday. And he, in wonderful diplomatic speak, said to us, "Well, we'll try and see if we can do something for the gentleman, and I can't say anything." But by Thursday night, Mubarak was in Toronto. And he was immediately provided with asylum under complementary protection. And he is now a citizen, and you'll see him in the film. Matus Collado was in Australia for 3 years in Villawood, and on one famous occasion got into a blue with a guard at Villawood and smacked him one in the mouth and ended up in Silverwater Jail, where he was raped. And then soon after he did his time there, he was deported back to Angola, where he was 9 months in prison. 9 months in prison. He managed to get out of that through an uncle who, largesse his way out with the local authorities. He made his way to Britain, where he tells the story. He turns up at Heathrow Airport, and there was a sign on gate 14 at the airport that says, if you've come to seek asylum, just stand here and someone will help you. My daughter saw this, and she said, when we were filming this film, we were in London on the way through to visit some of their success stories, and she said, "You know, Dad, it's amazing, you get to Heathrow Airport and there's signs up saying, if you're seeking asylum, go to gate 14. You know, what is it we're afraid of here? What is it we were afraid of? Brian Dawe said to me the other night when he saw the film, he said, "You know, we wouldn't have needed this policy in Australia if we just had a bloody moat around the country. I mean, just imagine if Australia was an island surrounded by water. We wouldn't have needed it." So it seems to me it's important for us to put the measures of complementary protection in place. Matus Collado tells a story after his years in detention here of turning up at Heathrow Airport and being taken to a hotel and pulling back the windows and seeing the cars going by and saying, "Ah, it's freedom. This is freedom." Now, within 4 months, he was granted asylum, and he is now a citizen of the UK and a brickies labourer in Wolverhampton. So what is it about being a refugee that the United Kingdom understood that we don't? Of the people that we have tracked down and have advocated for, a number of them, good news, they have been resettled in the United States, in Canada, in New Zealand, in Sweden. So what is it that those jurisdictions understood about what it was to be a refugee that we somehow lost or forgot, this land of refugees and immigrants that we come from? So I would strongly, advocating and urging that the government's complementary protection provisions as putting on the table at the moment are fundamentally important. Particularly, we would like them to go further with regards to statelessness. The current model that you will see circulated today talks about the fact that while stateless persons within Australia have the same entitlement to apply for protection visa as any other non-citizen, statelessness itself is not proposed as a criterion for the grant of a visa on complementary protection grounds. I am worried that that's not going to be good enough. And it seems to me that when you come to people like Mubarak Naif, Matus Collado, the stateless people who cannot stay and therefore cannot go. Similarly with the vast array of Palestinians who live in the teeming, fetid refugee camps on the outskirts of Damascus, who sit there clutching these Australian identity documents, the only thing to prove who they might be. And because they had no avenue of a complementary protection visa, sadly still remain in a place where they cannot stay and they cannot go. Finally, I think the last point I wanted to make was we need to go somehow beyond this. Patrick Dodson is going to get the Sydney Peace Prize this week, and he talked the other day, and he got bucketed heavily for it. He talked about the fact that what we've got to try and get back to in Australia is, and it's not trendy and it's a bit twee and a bit, you know, it's not the normal thing you probably say at a legal seminar. But it seems to me this process happened because we just couldn't summon up enough love. And Patrick Dodson talks about the fact that where's the love for my people? And it seems to me in Australia over the course of the last 200 and so years, it's always been the first peoples and those who were the last peoples who seem to be those who find it the hardest to get access to the things that the rest of us take for granted. And whilst it's fundamentally important that we get complementary protection processes in place, it is also fundamentally important that in the hearts of our people we get to a point where compassion is not seen as weakness. And we can understand that when the refugees that have come to this country, they bring with them so much that the rest of us perhaps, I think, need. And besides that, we know within 10 years, one of those kids from the Afghans, from the Tampa, is going to be opening the bowling for New South Wales, and his sister will be scoring goals for Buccaneers at the Olympics. That's what happens here. Let's bury the fear, and let's try and draw together the things that make us strong. These provisions will help us do that. But somehow I think there's another job required that goes deeper. How do we get back the humanity that we lost? Perhaps the first step in doing that is to take responsibility for the things that we have done.